Welcome to the Specify Growth Podcast. I'm your host, Tats Nakagawa of Castagra Products. Each week, I talk to leaders and experts about how to overcome adversity, grow massive organizations, and how to create meaningful change in the building materials and construction industry. Today's guest is Lisa Diaz. She's the managing partner and founder at Turf Advisory. All right, Lisa, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. This is an exciting opportunity.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking at your background. What really sticks out is your finance background, Goldman Sachs. So it's not just a little bit of finance. You were deep in there. Tell me about that world.
So I bought my first stock when I was 14, Dunkin' Donuts, and I quickly learned that it's a useful idea to have your money work for you. So I bought my stock when I was 14. When I was 17, my dad said, I wanted to go on this trip. And my dad's like, you can't go. And I was like, yes, I can. Have you heard of something called a dividend? So I took my dividend and I went with my friend Laura Goldie to Florida. So I realized early in life, money is freedom and opportunity and to do whatever you want to do. So that got me down the path of Wall Street and investment. So I love the investment process. Whenever I'm in any environment, I look for ways to improve profitability, rates of return. That's just how my mind thinks.
You got me curious. Why that stock at 14? Like, did you get a tip? Like, what happened? What was your
problem? No, I didn't get a tip. And I'll tell you, it's a crazier story. So I was working at Robert's Toy Town at age 14, and I would take my money to the bank where I was making like a penny. And I said to my dad, I'm like, I want my money to work for me. And he's like, go talk to your Uncle Jimmy. So my Uncle Jimmy said to me, do you know what a stock is? I'm like, I'm 14. Well, now 14-year-olds know, but you know, in my generation, it was not a thing. So he told me about a stock as a piece of a company. And he said, I want you to think about a product that you like the product, you like the marketing, and you think they have a unique, you know, kind of value proposition. So I came back and I used to like, and I still like Dunkin' Munchkins. And in those days, there was this really good marketing from, you know, I think we're the same vintage. There was the guy making the donuts with the little, and he was out there making the donuts. And then my Uncle Jimmy said to me, he goes, well, you know, they own their real estate. I mean, this is when I was 14. I don't think they still do. And I was like, oh, so I want to make this investment. So the skills that one requires in investing at age 14 or being some, you know, if you listen to Warren Buffett, who's one of the best investors out there, he has much more of a clean, simple approach to investment. And so when I just watched a podcast he did recently, he did a speech and it was talking about like, how do you find great companies? And his piece of recommendation is you want to have your consumer or your customer have a delightful experience. It's not always about the price, but it's whether they have an enjoyable experience. So going back to my Dunkin' Donuts experience, I used to love I still love going to Dunkin' Donuts. I like the color, I like the feel, I like the donuts, I like the coffee. So what they provide is a delightful customer experience. I mean, that doesn't work in, you know, all businesses, but even in tech businesses, right? So part of the reason Apple is so successful is you have a delightful customer experience. One of my favorite, you know, views on Apple is they have the Genius Bar. And the Genius Bar is, in fact, for people that are not geniuses. My Silicon Valley educated daughter would die rather than going to the Apple Genius Bar, but mom is there. But mom feels like they can go to the Genius Bar. You're treated with respect. They fix your iPhone or your, you know, Mac or whatever they do. And it's just a great customer experience. And if you look at the value that Apple does, it's because they add value to you. They make you feel important. They solve your issues. And there are all these stories about people switching from their Apple, your iPhone to an Android. It's like worse than getting divorced and moving. So people just don't do it. So that's it. With investment, I think people often think about like the numbers, but I really start more like Warren Buffett, and if it's okay with more, it's like, what's the experience? Like, do they deliver value to the customer? Do they do something that's useful? Do they do something that gives you repeat business? Do they treat their employees well? Because employee churn, like if you go to Starbucks, for example, they'll recognize you. So I'm sure you have your local Starbucks. They give you your latte and they're like, hey, Lisa. And then, you know, hey, John. And you feel like there's this little personal experience. So that's kind of how I look about investments. And my own children, when they were young, we bought, you know, their first stock. And my older daughter, who's at business school, which is kind of entertaining. So we went through the process and they heard the Dunkin' Donuts story like forever. So my daughter's like, Mom, but you don't go to Dunkin' Donuts. You go to Starbucks. And then the other thing she told me years later, she's like, Mom, do you remember when we were in Paris and you wouldn't feed me? And I was like, Gabriella, really? She's like, no, we went to a Starbucks and they gave me this croissant and it was a delicious croissant. And we went to the Jardin de Luxembourg and I was in this beautiful garden eating this croissant. And because of that, I've always loved Starbucks. I was like, good for you. Anyway, P.S. So when she was 7, we bought her $2,000 or $2,500, I forget how much, of Starbucks. So when she's off to go to business school, she has to pay. And she's like, well, Mom, my Starbucks stock is worth $75,000. I was like, what? So, you know, even though I was part of buying this stock, we went through the whole process and she's 27. When she told me it was $75,000, I was like, really? That's quite impressive. So that's why I think it's really important to teach your children the value of investment and making your dollars work for you. And so I think that finance develops, it actually has a purpose in society because all of us want to figure out a way to get our money to work for us so that we can do the things that we want to do. Like I want to go with my friend Laura Goldie to Florida. I've kind of changed in my daughter wants to pay to go to business school. And so I think it's really important, especially, you know, I think, you know, there's this kind of fear around investing. It's not that difficult. If, you know, Lisa, age 14, figured out Dunkin' Donuts, and I wish I still had it, it'd be worth tons of money, but it was taken private twice. But Gabriella, when she was 7, and it's worth $75,000, which, you know, is pretty decent amount of money made from a 7-year-old.
Very, very cool. So from investing, that first investment, you really took it far, you know, being, I think, managing director at Goldman Sachs. How was that process? You know,
it was many years. I was at Goldman for 23 years. I was the fixer. So my job at Goldman Sachs was to find clients that, believe it or not, were mad at Goldman Sachs for whatever reason. And I would figure out how to turn them from being against that into being prosumers. So what I would tend to do, and this is my playbook, I shouldn't tell everybody, but I will. I would figure out a way to find one person within the organization to be my advocate or Goldman Sachs advocate, right? And often people, you have to figure out what's the pain point of a client. And the pain point doesn't necessarily have to be business. And this is actually a funny story. So there was a major sovereign wealth fund of China who wasn't happy with us. So the CIO came and I had sort of strategies of showing meeting with interesting people at Goldman. We had a lot of sort of super interesting people. And afterwards, we were having a drink or like having, you know, like a glass of wine. And I asked him, what's on your mind? And he blurted out, well, I'm trying to get my kid into this really competitive school in Hong Kong. And I was like, I think I can help you with that. So I had gone through this process with my own kids of having them be blue folders, which means I shouldn't tell everyone this, but you figure out a way that to sort of circle your kid, they're not going to get in. I mean, unless they're like Joe football player or something, but you just want the admissions people to spend a little bit more time and get engaged and kind of have an interesting story. So I said, look, you know, this is how it works in America. You're from Chengdu. I said, you know, people in the Communist Party? He's like, oh, yes. And I said, why don't you try to do this? So off he went. A month and a half later, he calls me up and he's like, guess what? My son got into this school. And I was like, oh, I'm so happy. He's like, can you come to Hong Kong in 2 days? And I was like, sure. I want to take you to lunch and say thank you. And I'm like, oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I go. He takes me to lunch and he said, okay, now I'm going to help you. I'm like, oh, thank you so much. So he's like, I'm the CIO, Chief Investment Officer. This is the broker vote. So the broker vote is like, you know, who gets the most votes gets the most allocation of commission. And he's like, I diagnose this for you. These are the people you should talk to. They'll like you. You like your approach. I've set up meetings with all of them for the next, you know, for the next 2 days. Are you available? And I was like, thank you so much. Anyway, by the end of the year, we went from being terrible to being like top three. And my boss couldn't figure out like how I actually did it. But it wasn't doing, he wasn't as concerned about investment returns, right? There were, you know, tons of different, but he was really worried about how to get his kid into this school. So my approach was always to try to figure out, understand the person and what was top of mind and what was their particular pain point and problem, and then try to find a solution. Because again, if someone is takes away your pain or makes your life easy, you're going to help them. So, you know, this was a long-winded way to talk about finance. So that's what I did within Goldman Sachs. So I would be the fixer of a lot of good relationships. And then my reputation was Lisa can always figure things out. So I would have these, you know, very marquee names, and they would be like, hey, can you help me with this? Can you mentor my daughter? Can you help figure this out? And I was like, no problem. And I still have stayed in touch with them. So like going again to your, there's not one way to be successful in finance. You have to find a way that works for you. So, you know, I was a very high performer. I was also very creative about different ways to run business. I came up with, you know, different strategies. And I, as you can tell, I love investments. I love figuring out how to run businesses better. And I spent, you know, a large part of my time doing this. And you got to ask the next question. So how the hell did you ever go from being a managing director at Goldman Sachs to working in construction?
Well, there's another question I want to ask just before that. If okay. Someone approaches you now and says, hey, I want to become that fixer, but how do I get people to open up to me about their number one problem? What would you tell them?
So you ask them questions. Tell me about you. You know, people like to talk. People like to talk about themselves. So you ask open-ended questions. So it's kind of like you're playing tennis. You have to anticipate what the other person is asking, right? And over time, you have to kind of understand what's your competitive edge? Like, what can you do to help people? And there's certain like axioms in life. I mean, I'll tell you like what my playbook is, like arrows. I'm a serial mentor. I have like 85 mentors. It's, you know, what I like to do. And either people want to be mentored in their own career, or they have kids they want to mentor, or they have employees that they need help with. So the whole mentoring space is like a big space, which I've always kind of used as one of my playbooks. The second thing, again, for me is I've had a good track record of getting, you know, children or people into prestigious schools. So I have 18 or 19 mentees who've gone to Harvard Business School. I have 4 that are at Stanford Business School. So people kind of, that's a pretty good playbook. And then the latest kind of part that I've added value is I'm a breast cancer survivor. So I got breast cancer 5 years ago, and I use, you know, this weakness or, you know, the lemon to make lemonade. So I tend to have conversations about how do you recover from failure? How do you recover from a setback? Something doesn't go according to plan. So those are like my 3 things that I, and usually one of them works with the person who's mad, you know, who you're trying to engage with. But you have to do some research on the person and figure them out. So my father was a litigator. And one of the things that we learned is you never ask a question in a courtroom that you don't know the answer to, or you think you can know an answer to. So when you're trying to engage with these people, you need to kind of figure or make some assumptions about what's important to them, right? I mean, and sort of invest some time to know like what makes them tick. And especially with social media, it's pretty easy to figure out like a couple points of connectivity.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you got me curious about how do you come back from a failure or major challenge?
A major setback. So part of it is mindset. Okay. Let me be totally honest. It's a struggle for me to do. Okay. So the word failure, mistake, setback is negative, right? But if instead you reframe it and say, this is a learning, this is an opportunity. And if you think about Thomas Edison, it's like, I mean, you know, whatever, or Elon Musk talks about, or Warren Buffett. So if you sort of take a setback as, okay, I learned something from this, I won't make this mistake again. And, or I won't, mistake, that's the wrong word. This was a learning experience so I can move forward. So part of it is just to change your framework or your mind's eye towards a setback. And also you can make a decision. When I first started working on Wall Street, I remember this guy, Fred Reams from Reams Asset Management, who left a big impact in my life. He's probably no longer with us. And he said something interesting to me. And he said, you know, Lisa, there are two types of investors in the world. There are optimists and there are pessimists. And they're both right 50% of the time. And he said, I choose to be an optimist because optimists are more pleasant people to be with. They tend to be happier people. And I want to have that type of lifestyle. So recovering. So I have a positive, optimistic mindset. That does not mean I don't complain. I get negative, like I'm a normal person. But if you try to see like, okay, the glass is half full, not half empty, it radiates through your whole life. And then the other thing that happened to me with cancer is I really developed more faith. And faith doesn't mean religion, but it's a sense of that there is, you know, a flow or karma in the universe. And then even from the bad aspects or challenging times, there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel. So I would say that. So just putting in it, so having a more positive mindset. So you don't use the word mistake, failure, you say learning. A learning is different, right? Learning, I'm smarter as a result. Secondly, say to yourself, we shall overcome, right? So great leaders, you know, they have a vision of the possible. Like, don't fool yourself. Like Winston Churchill knew that things were not looking good for England. Let's be honest, right? But he had a positive, you know, kind of mindset that other people could kind of coalesce around. And then thirdly, if you take the view that you're here for a purpose and there's a higher kind of positive learning, you have a sense like there's a reason why this is happening. So like when I think back of my cancer, it was a very positive thing for me. And my doctor's like, you were a rare patient. And he told me that you could tell, not 99, but the patients who have a positive mindset, they have a much better chance of recovery. So those are things that you can take control of. Like bad things are going to happen, right? I mean, you know, you can't be in a bubble. But when they happen, you're not devastated. You're like, okay, learning experience. I'm going to be smarter. It's going to be okay. You know, it will move in the right direction. So that's what I do. I don't know if it's worked for me.
Wonderful. And you correctly anticipated from all the stuff you did in finance and the business side, how did you make it to the construction side of things?
Well, it's a very strange story, but I'll tell you. So I have a mentor whose name is Rob Kaplan, who is vice president of Goldman. And then he was teaching at Harvard Business School and he was at the Dallas Fed. So he said to me, he's like, look, Lisa, here's the deal. There's a life cycle in finance unless you do high net worth. And like you get to a certain age and like, you know, it's kind of time to move on because you can look at across the board. I worked since I was 14. I'm planning to work till I'm 90 or 95. You know, my grandmother worked past 100. So like, and I knew I couldn't be working at Goldman Sachs till I'm age 90. So I was thinking about this and here's what happened. Okay. I commuted through Grand Central Station every day for years and I missed my train by 10 seconds. Oh, so frustrating. Negative thing, but an opportunity. And I always noticed that there was this tour of Grand Central Station that tourists were taking. So I just kind of go on this tour and I learned two really significant things was one, Jackie Onassis saved Grand Central from being torn down like Penn Station. Like there's a plaque now, but there wasn't then. I was like, wow, that's so cool. This woman I admire saved this beautiful place that makes me happy. People get married there. It's in movies. And I'm like, wow. And then the second thing, and so it was permanent. It's lasting. It's a backdrop. So check that box. And then the second thing was there's like a spot on the ceiling of the main, you know, sort of passageway of Grand Central. And it's a reference to a construction worker who came up with the idea that using lemon, you could clean the ceiling of Grand Central. And I was like, wow, this is a lasting, powerful thing. And this Grand Central will be here for another 100 years. So I sat in the train. And by the time I came back home, I told my husband, I want to work in construction. I want to build something. I want to know, do something that's lasting. And my husband's like, what do you know about construction? I'm like, I'll figure it out, because I learned at Goldman Sachs, like how to learn something new. So here's what I learned about construction. Very large addressable market. It's about 5% of GDP, 5 or 6% of GDP. It was the second least, or is the second least, digitized after agriculture. There are very few women in it. So I'm like, I know how to work with men. I worked in finance. And then the other thing I noticed, which came later, is people skew kind of on the old side. So for example, the head of the Port Authority is in his 80s, and that's not a big deal. So I said, okay, I want to do something that is lasting and has legacy. I want to do something where I can teach problem solver. I want to solve this problem of how to be more efficient, and I can work until I'm 90. So that's kind of what I did. And it's interesting. I went to Cappadocia this year, and they have these caves. And in these caves, there's a picture of, you know, like Jesus Christ, a saint, and then whoever had contributed the money to build this, you know, place, this, you know, in the foothills of Cappadocia from like 300 AD. So I was like, all these finance people want to do something that's lasting. So I'm just like the people from Cappadocia from 300, you know, AD. So that's my story. It's kind of strange, right?
I love it. So where do you see this all going for you?
Really, there's a couple motivations. One, I feel I'm a big feminist. I'm a fourth generation working woman, and I have two daughters. I got to be MD at Goldman Sachs, but I didn't get to be partner. So frankly, that was a top rung. 400 people got to be partner when I was there. So I was like, but I decided that having a happy marriage, I've been married for 31 years, having, you know, high performing children. Both of my daughters are at graduate school at Stanford. Like, you know, I mean, that means something to me, but I want to be able to show that your career can last longer. So when I first graduated from school, there was this Anjali commercial, which is you can bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, and never, never let your partner forget you're a man. And I was like, how the hell did she do that? Well, it's not possible. But what's possible if you work till you're 90, you can do it all. So my plan is I would like to become a force in construction. So to encourage more women, diverse people to join construction, I would like to be able to imbue construction with more technology and efficiency. And I actually lately have decided is I would like to purchase a more traditional construction company in the MEP space and run it better, put in that technology, put in this efficiency, and to be able to really demonstrate how technology can improve profitability, how it can allocate capital more effectively. And that's kind of my plan. So I have a bunch of years I'm going to work. I don't know what else to do besides work, but, you know, sorry about that. I have friends and everything. I have hobbies, but like, I row. And part of the reason I row is you go in at 5:30 in the morning, you're done by 7:15. Everybody's like waking up. So that's my plan.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to share?
I think life is long and you have to think about what's the legacy that you want to leave. So when I say cancer was a blessing, I think, you know, not to be negative, but we're all here. We have a expiration date. And I think it's really important to do like the work back or the Tom Sawyer story to think about like when your time comes, what do you want people to be saying? What's the legacy you want to leave? What do you want your life to be about? And money is important, don't get me wrong. But I think like when you're at that final moment, I don't think that's what most people really think about. So my one sort of aspiration, recommendation is to do the work back, to say like, okay, you know, when they told me I had cancer, my roommate from college died from cancer, from breast cancer, my other friend died from cancer. So dying was a very possible outcome. It still is a possible outcome. And so I did a work back and said to myself, okay, what was it that I wanted to kind of leave behind? What was going to be my legacy? And one of them was mentoring. And another one is I would really like to be part, and my friend Steve Platon knows this, I'd like to be part, they're going to change and, you know, revitalize the New York City bus terminal, which is the not a very nice place. And me and Steve Plate, more Steve Plate than me, who's from the Port Authority, I want to make it be a destination, a super cool place. Kind of like when they did the High Line. Everyone's like, are you crazy? And now there's High Lines anywhere. So I want my grandchildren to go there or whoever it is and say like, you know, grandma had a small part in leaving this legacy that endures, like Grand Central endures, like those caves in Cappadocia endure. So that's important for all of us to say, like, do your work back. Say, like, when my time comes, don't wait for, you know, it doesn't mean you have to wait for tomorrow, but you should sort of have a plan of what you want to leave and, you know, how the life you want to live. And it can be money. It can be you want a gold medal. It could be, you know, whatever. You want to start a great company. You want to do a nonprofit. Like, there's no right answer. It's the answer that works for you.
Well said. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And hopefully the world is, we together can evolve the world. So thank for what you're doing as well, because you're communicating messages and you're giving people an opportunity to think about their life in a different way. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Specify Growth podcast today. Make sure you check out youtube.com/TatsTalks for video of today's podcast. Hit the subscribe button for upcoming episodes.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.